We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
Extend life. If we would argue what to do and not to do with a dying patient 100 years ago, the question could have been whether to say another capital Tehillim or less of a capital Tehillim. But otherwise, nothing really could have been done for this dying patient, and therefore the questions were more theoretical, philosophical, theological, but not practical. Nowadays, that we can do things for a dying patient and extend his life, whether by respirators or intensive care treatment or dialysis or chemotherapy or radiotherapy and so on, then the question comes up, since we can do it, are we obligated to do it? Since we can do it, can we stop doing it? And so on. And therefore, the question has become more complicated in recent years. Let me just set the stage before turning to what has happened lately in Israel on this matter and the unique proposal for legislation that I just handed over to the Minister of Health, which is very different than any other country in the world. We are always different, and in this case as well. So really, there are several ethical considerations and principles governing the decision-making process concerning the dying. The major two opposing values are the value of life and the principle of autonomy. On the basis of the principle of autonomy, one could argue that the question what to do with a dying patient depends on the dying patient. Whatever he wants to be done for him, based on his value system, on his psychological or social requirements or his wishes or whatever he wants, that is the right thing to do for him. It can be either to extend his life or not to extend his life or even shorten his life. Autonomy as a principle that respects the self should make the decision easy on this aspect, so that we only have to ask the dying patient what he wants, whether at the time when decisions have to be made, provided he is competent and can make decisions at that time, or by an extended autonomy, such as an advance directive or witnessing what he wished to be done with him once he becomes a dying patient, in case he is at that time incompetent. So that is one extreme way to solve the problem. The other side of the coin is the value of life. If we would assume that the value of life is an absolute value, and in philosophy, when you talk about an absolute value, you mean to say that there are no exceptions whatsoever to that value. Otherwise, it becomes a relative value to the exceptions. And therefore, if the value of life is an absolute value, everyone should be treated by all means to extend every minute of life, no matter what the quality of life is, no matter what his wishes are, because the value of life is an absolute value if we accept this assumption. So that these two extreme positions from an ethical point of view can solve the problem if we accept either of them, so that either we accept whatever the patient wants and then we follow the autonomy principle, or we extend each life by all available means and then we accept the value of life as an absolute value. I know of no place in the world that accepts either of the extremities. And therefore, what everyone is doing is trying to balance between the two opposing views. On the one hand, fulfill the wishes, the autonomous wishes of a patient, but not to whatever he wants and whatever he says. On the other hand, respect the value of life, but not in an absolute way, but in a relative way, and relative too, depending on the various decision-making processes in various countries. Let me give you a brief description on how Western societies in different parts of the world have or are solving this problem. I'll start with the Dutch solution, which is the autonomy overriding almost everything and paying very little tribute to the value of life as such. And therefore, in Holland, it became legalized only a year or two ago, but it was the practice for about 20 years, that active euthanasia is acceptable and currently legal, which means that if a competent patient comes and says, I don't want to live the next half year that is expected for me to stay still alive because I don't like this type of life that I have now, I am going to die anyway, I am suffering, I can't bear it, I don't want any treatments, I want to die, but I can't die now from the process itself. I'll die only in half a year. So what can be done? Someone has to kill me now in order to fulfill my wishes. And that is legal in Holland. You can inject a lethal dose of medication with a purpose of killing the patient so that his autonomous wishes will be fulfilled. Even in Holland, the autonomy is somewhat restricted because there are qualifications to fulfilling his autonomous wishes. For instance, he has to have a terminal illness, he has to be suffering by some criteria, and he has to be competent at the time that he is making the decision. If you go with the autonomy principle further, and you could, then why not accept the wish of a person who autonomously says, I want to die because I lost my job, not because I'm ill? Who are we to judge what are the reasons for the autonomous decision of another person? If we respect autonomy in an absolute way, then it should have gone far beyond even what the Dutch are doing. So that even the Dutch understand that autonomy is limited by norms of society. And society has some norms that restrict autonomy in a certain sense, but in their view, it restricts it in a very limited way, and in most medical instances, it is not restricted. I won't go into the slippery slope process and what is actually happening in Holland, so that no country in the world is willing as yet to adopt this model because of either philosophical reasons or slippery slope processes, and I won't go into it further, just to point out that this is a way that a Western society in the 21st century has made its own decision that this should be permissible. There are countries who are not going that far to allow active euthanasia, but they are going one step before that. And this is what is termed recently physician-assisted suicide, which means that a person who is competent, who has a fatal illness, who is expected to live less than 6 months, who is suffering and who wants to die now, not to wait for the process of the illness to kill him, can request from a physician to assist him to commit suicide. For instance, to ask the physician to prescribe a lethal dose of medication go to the pharmacy and take this little dose, swallow it and die. This is acceptable in Oregon, one of the states of the United States, and I think to date about 50 people have committed suicide in this way. What is the difference between the Oregon philosophy and the Dutch philosophy? Probably no difference. It is just that they're afraid to make the next move. But philosophically, it doesn't make any sense. If you are willing to accept the autonomy of the patient, and you are willing him to die now, why make him kill himself? Why not help him to kill? Why not kill him by a physician's direct intervention rather than indirect intervention in a sense of physician-assisted suicide. So they admit there's no real philosophical boundary between physician-assisted suicide and active euthanasia. It is just that it doesn't look nice to be in a stand of an active euthanasia, so they are still at the physician-assisted suicide. Probably it won't take long before it will move on to the active euthanasia. Other states in the United States, I don't know the law in Canada, but some Western European countries and all other states in the United States have a different approach. And they are trying to balance more in the middle between the value of life and the autonomy of the patient. And they are willing to withhold and to withdraw all treatments from a dying patient. Not to assist him to commit suicide, certainly not to kill him, but not to interfere with the dying process. You can do it by either not introducing new treatments so that the patient will not continue living and he'll die naturally whatever time will take to die of his illness. You can even start a treatment, give him a chance and see whether it will work, but once the decision is that it doesn't work anymore, stop this treatment and the patient will die because of, and that's not always clear, is it because you stopped the treatment and you actively hastened his death, or because you removed something which let the patient die of his natural illness? Now, what is meant by withholding and withdrawing all treatments? What is a treatment? So obviously, a respirator is a treatment, a dialysis machine is a treatment, chemotherapy is treatment. How about food and fluid? Is food and fluid treatment? If you will regard it as a treatment, then you can stop food and fluid as well. If food and fluid is something different, then you cannot stop food and fluid. You have to continue food and fluid, but not to give him other types of medications or other treatments. Currently, the accepted notion in the United States and in some European countries is that providing nutrition in a technical way, either by an NG tube or by a gastrostomy or by an IV, is a form of treatment. The fact that we introducing in this treatment nutrition and not a medication is, according to this philosophy, irrelevant. And therefore, when you make a decision not to continue treating a dying patient, you are allowed to withdraw and withhold even food and fluid, so that the patient will actually die of hunger and of dehydration before he'll die of his cancer or of his heart condition. That is the accepted norm in many countries in the world, in Western society. Other countries have ruled, or at least the normative procedure is, that you can withhold treatments, but you cannot withdraw treatments which will hasten death. And that is where they draw their line. So this is the scenery of what you do with dying patients legally and philosophically in a secular society in some of the Western countries. I don't know, as I said before, what the law in Canada is, and I certainly don't know what they do in Eastern Europe or in other parts of Asia. I don't know what their norms are there, but I'm just giving you some of the solutions in the world. In Israel, till this very moment, there is no law that regulates how a physician should treat a dying patient. There were several attempts to enact such a law, and because of a lot of debates between religious and non-religious, leftists and rightists, and you know, in Israel everything becomes a major issue, so certainly this is a major issue, and nothing was done legally because there was no agreement on how to deal with the matter. Around 2.5 years ago, a pilot, a well-known pilot in Israel, and this already makes it a special case, was ill with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a degenerative neurologic disease that causes a paralysis of all the muscles, including the respiratory muscles, and a patient at the advanced stages of ALS can move his eyeballs, sometimes can move a little finger, but other than that, he can't do any movements at all with his body, including his respiration, and in fact, he is dying of suffocation. The way to keep him alive is to put him on a respirator, and then he can continue living for a long period of time, and he is actually, his mind is fine, nothing is wrong with the brain, because this is not affected in the illness. And if he has a way to communicate, either with eye movements or with modern devices of communication, he can continue living that way for a long period of time. This pilot made a decision that when he will reach the end of his natural course, he does not want to be intubated, he doesn't want to be on a respirator, he wants to die because the quality of life of such a paralysis will be unbearable for him. When the time came, and it is apparently a very bad feeling of suffocation when you can't really breathe, he was convinced that it's worthwhile to put him on a respirator. And he agreed. And he was put on a respirator, and for a while he was on a respirator, and he couldn't bear it. He felt that it's too difficult for him to live that way, the communication wasn't good, he couldn't move, they needed a lot of help to move him, to avoid bed sores and so on, and he wanted to die. But he's now on a respirator. How will he die now? The only way to make him die is to remove the respirator, to withdraw the treatment that he is on. But it was very clear that by removing the respirator, he'll die of his illness, but it will be a consequence of the action of removing the respirator. And up to that point, legally, it was not allowed in Israel to do it, and no one has done it officially. I don't know what people do in the side that no one sees by agreements, but officially it was never done. So they decided to make it a test case, and they went to the district court in Tel Aviv, although he was in Jerusalem, but they knew that there is a judge in Tel Aviv whose opinion was that withdrawing a respirator is okay. So they went specifically to this particular judge, who became subsequently my best friend, although we don't agree on anything, but we were good friends subsequently, and he ruled that you can remove the respirator from this patient. And the respirator was removed, and the patient died. This was publicized, and it was a whole big to-do, and it created a big tumult in Israel. It went to the Knesset, and there were demonstrations and so on. And the Minister of Health decided to appoint a committee that will get to a proposal to regulate what is allowed and what is not allowed in a legislative form. It shouldn't be in the hands of this or that judge to make such kinds of decisions. And I was privileged to be appointed as the chair of this committee. We had a very large committee, 59 people, which probably was the largest committee ever in Israel on a specific issue. And remember that almost all of them were Jews, so they were expected to be at least 200 opinions on what is right and wrong. There were also non-Jews, because it was to be a legislation of the State of Israel, which has citizens who are non-Jews. So we had a Muslim, we had a Roman Catholic, we had a Druze, and we had other religions as well, but they were obviously a small minority. Most were Jews. And there were Jews from all walks of life, all experts. No politicians, no news people, just experts in this field. This committee was divided into four subcommittees. Subcommittee of physicians, nurses, social workers, the scientific aspect of the dying, a subcommittee for legal matters, a subcommittee for philosophical matters, and a halachic subcommittee. And each subcommittee got the mandate to try to draft full legislation according to their viewpoint. And I got four different proposals. I made out of it a proposal, and then we went over step by step as the whole committee. And surprisingly enough, 80% of the members agreed to the full legislative proposal of this committee. Of the 20% who were the minority opinion, only a few were a minority opinion on one specific issue. Some had reservations about here and there different points in the legislative proposal, so that really the vast majority agreed to what we have proposed. The proposal is composed of over 100 paragraphs. It's a very detailed law, over 20 definitions of terms, some very innovative for our purpose. And out of these 100 paragraphs, as I said, 80% accepted all of them, and of the 20%, some had reservations, isolated reservations, and only a few had combined reservations. So this is the setup. Now, what is the proposal? The proposal was based on a few assumptions. One assumption was, and I'm not going in any order, just to bring up all these assumptions. One assumption was that we are not going to extremes. Neither the value of life is an absolute value, nor the autonomy is an absolute value. We are going to a balanced approach between the two extreme values, and we have to draw a line somewhere which will make sense to some people and won't make sense to others. But no line will be a line that everyone will agree that this is the line. It's impossible. As soon as you make a decision to balance between opposing values, then you are about to have different opinions. Where exactly do you draw the line? So I'll explain to you in a minute where we drew the line and why. But not everyone agreed to this line that we drew. So that is one assumption. Second assumption was that most people want to live, but they don't want to suffer, and they don't want to live artificially. As opposed, for instance, to the Dutch philosophy, and I think in a great degree to the American philosophy, that most people want to die. We don't believe that most people want to die. If you give them a reasonable quality of life as far as pain is concerned. I'm not talking about coming to this lecture as a standard for being alive or not. I'm talking about pain and suffering. If you give them a quality of life without pain and suffering, and if you let them to decide not to extend artificially their life, they want to live as long as they can. That was one assumption, that this is the majority. There are two minorities. There is one minority who wants to live by all means, no matter what, even if they suffer. They feel that life is so important that they want to continue living. That is a minority, I think a very small minority, but it certainly exists. And there is another minority that wants to die. They just don't want to live anymore. Not that they want to live without pain and without artificial extension of life, they just don't want to live. And we believe that this is a small minority as well. So when we drafted a proposal, we had in mind to draft a proposal which will gear for the majority of people, like every law goes for the majority, but to have in mind solutions for the two minorities on the two ends of the spectrum. The third assumption was that people want to control the way they are going to die. But how do you do it? So there are four subpopulations at the time of dying concerning our ability to know what they really want or don't want. One small minority usually is a subpopulation that at the time of the dying process are fully competent, and therefore you can ask them, and they'll tell you, we want intubation, we don't want intubation, we want another course of dialysis, we don't want. They are fully competent at the time that a decision has to be made. But most people, when they are in a dying process, they want. So there are several ways to find out what they want. One way is that while competent and healthy, all of us now, we can make sure that our wishes will be known at a time when we will become dying patients and we will be incompetent. For instance, by writing an advance directive, by appointing someone who will make the decision for us, assuming that this one that we chose will know what we want and will do the best for us, but we appointed him, not a guardian that the court appoints when already the person is incompetent, because this guardian doesn't know what the patient really wants, because he was appointed after he became incompetent in order to make decisions for him. In our view, in our proposal, he is irrelevant because he doesn't know what the patient really wants. The one who is relevant is someone that the patient appointed when he was competent and discussed with him what he really wants. A third possibility is what the relatives are saying. But here I don't know again what the status in Canada of a relative is concerning what to do with a dying patient who is their relative, but we felt, and there are a lot of studies to support our feeling, that relatives really don't know what their next of kin wants. When they say, do this for him or don't do this for him, they really mean, we want it this way. It's not that he wants it. We want it this way, but we say that this is what he wanted. But they really don't know. How do they know? Moreover, usually the next of kin, the closer he is from a genealogical point of view, has more power to make decisions. So if it is a son or a brother or a father, he is closer than an uncle or than a neighbor who is not relative at all. But imagine someone who lives in Toronto, has a brother in Jerusalem, he never saw him for the past 20 years, and now this brother in Jerusalem is going to die, and he comes, I am his closest relative, and do this for him, and don't do this for him. Who are you to tell us what to do? What do you know about him? Just the fact that you were born to the same set of parents doesn't make you more knowledgeable what is good or bad for this particular patient. Moreover, a study that we did showed that we did a study on a geriatric population where offspring made decisions for their parents. If there was more than one offspring, they were in 50% more than one opinion. So that the son said, do this, the daughter said, do that, and the third son said, don't do either of them. So now how do you decide? Who is the one that you'll choose? The one who is the loudest, the one who is the more pushy, who is the one to make decisions? They're all the same next of kin. And you hardly find a family that all of them agree that this is the right thing to do. So therefore, we said that it doesn't matter whether he is a family or not. He may be his best friend, and he has better rights to make decisions than his brother, who doesn't know him at all. His best friend, who took care of him, who is coming to the hospital every day, who washes him, who talks to him, he probably knows better what is good for him than his brother, who lives in Toronto and doesn't know anything about him. So it's not the family situation, it is more how close the person is to the patient in order to make the decisions, and it has to be a clear testimony of the next of kin or the friend that this is what the patient told him he wants. Not that we assume that this is what he would have wanted. That is not enough. Okay, if there'll be more questions on that, I'll answer, but I think that is a change in the whole concept of the decision makers as far as family and friends are concerned. So that is another way to know what the patient wants or would have wanted. Now, with the advanced directive, or what it used to be called the living will, there's a problem. Let's say a 20-year-old person who has his mind in football and in basketball, and that's the life that he envisions worth living. He writes an advance directive which is, in a way, representing how he feels when he is 20 years old. He keeps it in his pocket, and now he becomes 80 years old, and he becomes incompetent, and he is a dying patient. And you take out his living will, should you follow it? Is it really what he now wants? Is it exactly now what he wanted 20 years ago? Did he change his mind? Maybe now he has other expectations. Maybe he wants to live another 2 weeks to see the grandchild's bris or something that is expected to be born. There are other expectations to different ages. And statistics show that about 30% who write advance directives change their mind during the course of life. So if you write once an advance directive, and this should be binding, you may in 30% be wrong. And being wrong in a dying situation is a life and death decision. There's no going back. Therefore, we require that an advance directive has to be renewed or updated every 5 years. And once the person becomes a patient and he is diagnosed with the illness that is going to lead him to die, he has to renew it again once he already knows that he has this illness that is going to kill him. And only then we think is what he is writing a valid documentation of what he really wants. Now, how do you do it? A driver license that you have to renew, no one of us remembers that you have to renew it, right? There is an authority that reminds you, otherwise no one will renew ever anything. So certainly a living will, until you already write it, you wrote it, you won't remember to do it every 5 years. So we proposed to establish a central bureau of advance directives where everyone who wants to write an advance directive will send in the advance directive, and it will be the responsibility of this central office to send reminders to renew it the same way as you do with a driver license. If for a driver license you do it, so for life and death matters, you surely should do it. By the way, this was the only objection of the Minister of Health to the proposed law, because he said it will cost me money. I have to establish it's a bureaucratic matter and it will cost money. I don't have money. But I think it's a very important point, although it sounds very trivial, but without thinking about the trivial things, just to give statements and philosophical assessments, I don't think it will work ever. So this is as far as a patient who is dying, non-competent, but once he was competent. Now there is a second subgroup of people who were competent, who are now incompetent in a dying situation, but that they have no advance directives. And most of the population doesn't have advance directive, even where it's legally binding. In the United States, I think only about 20% of the population has advance directives. I don't know the situation in Canada. But I'm sure that in Israel it will be even less. I don't think that Friday night at the table the discussion will be how am I going to die and what should I write in my advance directive. That's talking about dying in Israeli and in a Jewish ethos is in a way a taboo. We don't talk about dying, and therefore probably the number of people who will write advance directives, although it will become binding, will be small. So how do we know what to do with an incompetent dying patient, even though he was competent, but we don't have any evidence for him? So this is a subgroup that we had to deal with. And then there is a fourth category of people who are incompetent while dying, but they were never competent even before. Take the population that I deal with. I deal with pediatric neurology. I deal with kids who were born very defective, mentally retarded, but they are dying also at some point, either as children or as adults. But they were all their lives totally incompetent. So no one would ever know what their real wishes would have been if we could have asked them, because there's no one to ask. So we have to deal with this subpopulation as well. So this is as far as autonomy is concerned, to make a decision based on what a patient wants. Now, the medical side of it. We made a decision that we are talking about a dying patient that is very specifically defined. In the United States and in some countries in Europe, everyone whose quality of life isn't good is automatically a dying patient. If someone has Alzheimer's and he started with his Alzheimer's disease by forgetting his wife's name, he is already a dying patient. And some may decide not to treat him because an Alzheimer is not worth living. That is, in our view, wrong. The fact that he doesn't remember his wife's name is not a death penalty, right? It's not a reason to let him die. So therefore, a dying patient is a dying patient, not someone that can live 20 years in a quality of life that some people don't like, including extremes such as persistent vegetative state, who can live for 20 years. He's not a dying patient. So he does not enter into the proposal of our law. The proposal of our law says that a patient is a dying patient if he has a fatal, incurable illness causing suffering and expected to die within 6 months. So that if someone has the first lesion of a malignant melanoma, and you know that within 10, 15 years he'll die, now he is still not a dying patient. He has a fatal illness, he has an incurable illness, but he still has more than half a year to live. So therefore, he should live the time that is allotted to him. Once he enters the final half year of his expected survival, he falls into the category of the dying patient that this proposal applies to. Obviously, there are significant problems from an epidemiological point of view. How do you decide who will live half a year and how much of a mistake can you make here? Again, we dealt with this as well, and again, I won't go into every detail. So this is the framework of the law. Now, in order to answer to the majority of population, which I remind you are people who want to live, but they don't want to suffer, and they don't want to extend their lives artificially. So according to our proposed law, it is obligatory to provide palliative care. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one other country so far in the world that has enacted it as an obligatory legislative obligation to provide palliative care. It is not an option, it is not a good Samaritan way, it is not a good standard of medicine, it is obligatory. Every patient who is dying, according to our criteria, should receive palliative care. So that the drive to kill oneself or to commit suicide will be much reduced. Because if most people say, we want to live but we don't want to suffer, here, you won't suffer. Palliative care today takes care of almost all patients that they are painless. And if you do it well, you can even reduce a lot of the suffering, even if it's not pain, the psychological, emotional, and so on. And therefore, if you provide good palliative care, you'll reduce the number of people who want to die. This is, by the way, validated in the differences between England and Holland. In Holland, there is a large proportion of people who request active euthanasia. Palliative care in Holland is close to zero. They don't provide palliative care. So you can understand, even though I don't agree with them, but I can understand that people who are on the verge of dying, who are suffering, who have no other outlook, want to die because they don't want to suffer. In England, where the hospice movement has started and is very active, there is a very low percentage of people who request active euthanasia because they know they have an option. They don't need to die by someone killing them in order to be free of pain. They can have a hospice service either at home or in hospital hospice and reduce their pain and suffering. So therefore, we proposed to enact it as a law. Again, the Minister of Health was upset about it because this means to provide a lot of budgets and to advance the field of palliative medicine, which is a new branch in medicine, and it means to educate physicians to it, and it means hospitals, and it means home service, and so on. But without it, I don't think that it makes any sense to continue. So this is one point. The second point is that one is allowed, according to our proposed law, to request to withhold treatment. And if he requests it, the law will allow it. Which may sound to you, maybe, strange from a Jewish point of view. Because I think that the public at large thinks that according to Jewish law, according to halakha, you're not allowed to withhold treatment if you can extend life. And the answer is absolutely no, according to most prominent authoritative poskim nowadays. You are allowed to withhold treatment if it causes continuous suffering or pain. So therefore, if someone is dying of an illness, and you can give him another set of chemotherapy, or you can intubate him, or you can put him on a dialysis machine, and he'll live another few weeks. But living another few weeks means extending his suffering. You're allowed not to provide this treatment, and the patient will die naturally of his illness. This is very well founded in Shulchan Aruch already, and before it in Sefer Hasidim. There are a lot of sources to it, and again, if we'll have time, I can go into it from the halachic point of view. So this is validated halachically that it's permissible. However, there is a difference between the halachic approach of what you allowed not to do or to do at the dying process as far as DNR order are concerned, and what at least the American philosophy teaches. You're allowed to withhold treatment, but you're not allowed to withdraw treatment. Now, this is not correct the way I stated it. It depends on how you word it. What you are not allowed is to actively withdraw a treatment that is a continuous treatment, which by withdrawing it, the patient is going to die. And if you think about it, there's practically only one such situation, and that is a ventilator. A ventilator is a continuous treatment that supports the life of the patient, and if you actively withdraw it, the patient dies. All other regular treatments are intermittent treatments. For instance, take the dialysis machine. You need a dialysis in order to support the patient's life, otherwise he'll die of his kidney failure. But how do you apply a dialysis treatment? You give him 6-8 hours course Sunday, and he goes home. And he comes back Tuesday for another course. This other course is a new decision. Each course is a new decision. So you are allowed, according to most of the poskim, to make a decision in the course of an intermittent treatment not to renew the treatment in the next session. The fact that you as a physician have in mind that when you prescribe a treatment, you give it to an extended period of time, doesn't mean that this is how the treatment goes. The treatment is an intermittent treatment. Whereas a respirator is a continuous treatment and you have to intervene actively in order to stop it so that it will hasten the death of the patient, this is not so in an intermittent treatment. So therefore we introduced a terminology of continuous treatment and cyclic treatment, and there are differences between them. So that you're allowed to withhold treatment either by deciding not to start it altogether or by not continuing it if it is an intermittent treatment. What you are not allowed is to stop a treatment which is continuous. I'll come to this back in a minute with a Jewish, always we have a Jewish cop, so we did something even for the respirator, and I'll explain to you in a minute what we did. But at the moment, this is how we propose the law, and this is based on most poskim, Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Avil Yashi, Rav Wozner, most poskim hold that this is correct halachically. There's another difference. The other difference is that halachically, you are allowed and withdraw a continuous treatment, you are not allowed. So that's out. Withholding, you are allowed, but not everything. You are allowed to withhold only those treatments which pertain to the dying process. Why? Because you decided that this patient is a dying patient. By this decision, you meant that the treatments for the illness that causes his death are no more effective. Because if they would have been effective, he's not a dying patient. If you can cure him, he's not a dying patient. So the fact that he's a dying patient means that this particular treatment is ineffective for this patient, and therefore you are not anymore a physician in the sense of someone who is doing an effective treatment to the patient. So you irrelevant to the dying process. As long as the patient is alive, His value of life is the same as my value of life. And if I need to eat, he also needs to eat. To tell that you are allowed to withhold food and fluid because he is dying of a cancer, when food and fluid is not contraindicated medically, I'm not talking about this situation, then it becomes a medical situation which is permissible. But philosophically, you are saying the following. He is going to die within half a year because he has cancer. I am going to let him die sooner of hunger because I want to withhold food and fluid. Why should you kill him sooner? You can kill me the same way. Withhold from me food and fluid and I'll die as well. So anything irrelevant to the dying process, you cannot stop even in a dying patient. Because remember, we are trying to balance between the value of autonomy and the value of life. We are not saying the value of life is an absolute value, but we are not nullifying the value of life. He is still alive. And as long as he is alive, he is entitled to the same treatments that living people need. What he is not entitled to, or what he can waive, are the treatments to his particular condition. He is dying of cancer, treatments pertaining to cancer you can withhold, but not other treatments. Therefore, for instance, if he has an expected survival from now for half a year, and he has cancer, but in the meantime he has a urinary tract infection, unrelated, because they put a catheter or something like this. So why should you withhold giving him antibiotics to treat this particular infection? You'll give him a course of 5 or 10 days of antibiotics, and the urinary tract infection will be cured. He will die later of his illness. But why let him die now of a urinary tract infection that you can treat, and it's unrelated to the dying process, just because he's anyway dying from another disease? So that is halachically not permissible, and therefore we proposed in the legislation to distinguish between treatments pertaining to the dying process versus treatments related to the fact that he is still alive. Obviously, there is a gray area there, because sometimes a patient who has cancer is going to die of an overwhelming infection as part of his dying process. Then this overwhelming infection becomes his dying cause. Then you don't need to treat it. But if it's an intermittent infection, or take another example, someone who is all his life diabetic, and he's getting insulin all his life, and now he has a different illness. He has a severe heart disease and there's no way to transplant him and he's going to die of heart failure. Why not give him insulin? It has nothing to do with the fact that he's going to die of his heart. He's still a diabetic patient that needs to control his diabetic condition. So you should continue with his insulin. This is very different philosophically and practically from the rest of the world as far as a dying patient is concerned. Now we also established... where am I? 7 minutes. 7 Jewish minutes? Now we also established a set of ethics committees in order to solve problems which we can't envision. And no one is kidding himself that even 100-paragraph legislation will cover all the eventualities and the possibilities. Life is much more complicated than we can envision, and therefore there will always be discrepancies and problems to solve on an individual basis. So we propose to establish a local ethics committee and a national ethics committee, with the assumption, and we said it very clearly, and I said it to the judge that I told you before, that we became friendly, and he was on my committee, that, and I said it to him very straightforward, I don't want you to make the final decisions. I don't want one judge with one viewpoint to make a decision. I don't see why a judge has more authority to make decisions on ethical matters such as the dying than anyone else in the street. What is his expertise to make such a decision? It's his personal background, his personal feeling, and he sits on the bench, therefore he makes a decision. I don't think that is the right way to do. Such a complicated matter that involves ethical, religious, social aspects has to be dealt with experts in the various fields. And therefore you need a committee to make such a decision and not one judge. A judge has to be part of this committee because there are legal matters as well. But they are not only legal matters. There are other matters as well. So therefore, a local ethics committee should deal with the problems on a local basis. If they reach a decision, they can reach a decision, and they make a decision, and it's acceptable, then this is how things will go on. If they can't reach a decision, or if their decision is appealed, someone of the parties is not happy with the decision of the local ethics committee, we are proposing a national ethics committee which will be composed of the best people in Israel from the various fields, philosophers, rabbis, ministers, qadis, whoever is needed for whatever decision, lawyers and so on. And this central national ethics committee will make the final decision rather than one person, be it a judge. And that was accepted even by the judge. So anyway, this is the framework of the proposed law. There are a lot of details in it, which obviously time doesn't permit to go into it, but I don't think even that it's important. But let me just conclude with another chiddush that we made in this law. Take this pilot that we started the story with, which really started the whole thing in Israel. He is fully competent. He can't talk, but he's competent. He is on a respirator now, but he doesn't want to be anymore on the respirator. What is the solution for him? Or, I said that there's another type of minority that says, we want to live by all means. You say that you don't have to intubate me because in this situation you are allowed to withhold treatment. But I want to live. What are the rights of these two minority groups? So it was easier to make a decision on the second minority group that I mentioned. The one who wants to live is entitled to live. We have to provide him whatever reasonable means are available in order for him to live. Obviously, from a Jewish point of view, it is right. From a secular point of view, it should be right. But it is not in the United States. In the United States, if a group of physicians decides that a treatment is what they call futile, then even if the patient wants it, he doesn't get it. Why? Because it's futile. Futile means that it doesn't achieve its purposes, and if it doesn't achieve its purposes, it's an added expense, and since we are limited in our resources, we have to allocate resources to better causes, that's not a good cause enough for this particular person to live another 2 weeks when it will cost so much money. So money talks, United States. And therefore, you won't get the treatment, even though autonomy is so important. But we have an overriding rule over autonomy, which is called money. And therefore, you won't get this treatment. We rejected this position. We felt that the value of life is more important than money for the following reasons. A, at least in Israel, we tried to analyze the costs of end of life. We couldn't get a reasonable number. No one knows how much it costs in Israel. You can't extrapolate it from other countries because every country has different type of budgetary calculations. We don't know how much it really costs. Maybe it doesn't cost so much. We don't know. But even if it costs much, I think personally that it is an invalid ethical consideration. Why? Because this person wants to live, and you are telling him You won't live. You'll die. Because we don't have enough money to treat you. Why don't we have enough money? Because we need this money for better purposes. Now, I want to see the dollar saved by killing or letting this patient die going for a better purpose. So you can say, yes, in general it goes for a better purpose. But in general it also goes for not a better purpose. I came here, I'm paid by Rabbi Kelman. I don't know if this is a good expense of money. Maybe this money, instead of inviting me and paying me, should go to save a patient's life. So why do you take away from a patient who is going to die now for the purpose of saving this money for other goods, which we don't know where these goods are going to and how they are being spent and what are the priority decisions there? And we know for sure that a lot of money, even though resources are limited, go for wasted causes. And therefore, we cannot allow ethically someone to die because we have limited resources and we claim that it goes for better purposes. But it's arguable, and our decision was that the value of life here is more important. Therefore, if someone says, although you are allowed to withhold treatment and let me die earlier, I want to live longer, you'll get appropriate treatment. There are some limitations there as well, and again, if there will be time, I'll tell you the limitations there. Now the other spectrum, someone who is on a respirator, it's a continuous treatment, but he doesn't want it anymore. What do? We said that withdrawing a continuous treatment is equated to killing the patient. So we can't kill him, even if he wants it. So we are working now on a timer. And the idea is the following. We are going to connect respirators to a timer, which will be set ahead of time for a specified period of time, let's say a week. And you get a patient with ALS and you tell him, you don't need to make now a decision to die because maybe you like your life the way it is when you are on a respirator. But you don't want us to put you on a respirator because you're afraid that once you're on the respirator, you'll never get off it. And if you don't like it, what will you do? So we have a solution for you. You'll be connected to a respirator on a timer. We will not stop it. The timer will stop it. Once the timer stopped it, it is exactly like a dialysis machine. Now there's a new decision to decide whether to reconnect you or whether to let you without the respirator. And therefore, we are turning a continuous treatment into an intermittent treatment. And obviously it sounds like a Jewish trick, like the Shabbos clock that we do every Shabbos, but we don't question it too much, right? It's convenient, it's good. So we say, okay, so we did a trick and it's fine. So A, I don't think if you think about it, the tricks are so bad. If they are reasonable and they serve a purpose and they are okay from a legal, halachic, ethical point of view, so what if it's a trick? But I think that it is not a trick. I think it is really a substantive advancement in our thinking. Because, as you know, a respirator nowadays is so programmed that when something stops it, it right away starts working. Imagine if it wouldn't be so that there is a power failure. All the patients will die. All the patients on a respirator will die if there will be a power failure, right? But it doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because the respirator is programmed in such a way that when there is a power failure, it automatically starts working on a battery so that a patient will not die. So it's an inbuilt situation that it is a continuous treatment. Now, it is not so simple. We are working on it, and we don't have yet the technical solution. I believe it's possible, but we need to invent such a timer that will be safe. Because if the timer will stop it in times which we didn't intend to, or will do some, or will be a power failure or whatever, then patients will die unnecessarily. So it means that we are reprogramming the machines. We are making a new machine, which will be substantively different from the machines today. So it's not a trick, it's a different machine. It's a machine that is planned to work a certain time and not more. And then it's a new decision. There's an added point to it. I won't go into the politics, which are very complicated in Israel. I now am in touch with both left members of Knesset and right members of Knesset and Haredim and those. And everyone has their reservations about this or that. But when I talk to Meretz people, which are the extreme left in Israel, who were very happy with the general framework of the law, but rejected the idea of not allowing to withdraw treatment. Said, we are a modern liberal country. If it's good for America, why isn't it good for us? So we want the same as America. That's the philosophy of many of the leftists. We are a country like every other country, and America is the model. There are a lot of good things in America, but not everything is good there, right? You know it better than us. So anyway, so they rejected it. They said, we want to allow withdrawing any treatment, no matter if it's continuous or non-continuous, because that is ethically validated in America, and we are a secular country, we should do the same. So I told one of the members of Knesset, you know, to withdraw a respirator, which is really to pull the plug in a clear terminology, you don't need a physician for. What's the big deal? You just pull the plug. I invite you to come to the hospital and pull plugs. And I want to see you how you feel when you pull the plug and the patient in front of you dies with your action. I don't think that emotionally, even if you think philosophically it's okay, that emotionally it's such a good thing. She was shocked. And it's to her credit that she admitted it. She didn't think about it. She knows it's good to tell the physicians, you do it, and she doesn't have to be involved. But when she thought about it, she said, you know what, you are right. And then I said, I think from a professional ethical point of view, it is wrong to impose on physicians to do such a thing. Because we as physicians have to have in mind treating patients, helping patients, but not executing patients. That is not a duty of a physician. Although you can cover it with saying that this is a passionate action and this is what a patient wants and this is part of my relationship with a patient, yet you are doing an act which is contrary to the ethos of a physician. A physician is not there in order to shorten life. Therefore, if you use a timer and you're really not doing anything actively, neither the member of Knesset nor the physician, then I think that at least from a professional ethical standpoint and from an emotional point, this is a very good solution. And she right away accepted it. And I proposed it to the Attorney General of Israel, who ruled in the case of this pilot that you allowed to withdraw the respirator in order to let him die. And when I pointed out to him that this is problematic from a halachic point of view, but from a halachic point of view we have a different solution which is acceptable and you get the same thing, he right away issued an order to all the ministries in Israel that they should reject any withdrawing of such treatments, and they should wait for the timer in order to do it. So now, legally, it can't be done anymore, even though this district court judge ruled the way he ruled. So I think that it is a trick in a way, but I think it is a very innovative thinking, not mine. It was already proposed years ago by Rabbi Waldenberg, one of the great poskim who agree that this is permissible halachically, and therefore we propose to use it in this legislative proposal. So in summary, it is a complicated matter. I don't know how the law will look after it will go through the Knesset. I know what I'm giving them. I don't know what I'll get from them. And people tell me that I won't recognize the law once it comes out from the other side, but hopefully, substantively, it will not be changed, and it will be according to halachic regulations within a democratic society with all the parameters of balancing opposing views. Thank you very much.
Questions. Okay. We'll take two questions. We'll keep it short. I do want to keep more or less on schedule, on Jewish schedule. Hold on a second. But before, we'll take a five-minute break right after the questions. Also, want to thank Dr. Steinberg for his very interesting and illuminating talk. He'll be speaking again, of course, at 2 o'clock on the aftermath of 9/11, and he'll be speaking here tonight, 8 o'clock, on the differences of authority in Jewish law and two questions quickly. Is the mic not working? I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, one.
There is, but it's in Hebrew. Israel speaks Hebrew. So that's why I didn't bring it. I would have brought it. Yeah, it's a very detailed report with explanations, with paragraphs that are debatable, what are the debates in it. It's very detailed, but it's all in Hebrew. It's about 150 pages. I can do it.
Okay.
One non-intermittent treatment of ventilators. One that usually comes before the artificial part. It presents particular problems, I think, from a holistic point of view, because, in fact, dealing with the heart, you may have seen down the road as it's starting to become feasible to keep people alive on the non-artificial part. It's not a good idea to intermittently stop the heart to see whether the patient wants to continue to live. There may be all kinds of adverse effects from possibly doing that. I'm wondering if you could possibly think about the implications of the artificial part and what the legislative difficulties will be in Israel and how likely to deal with that.
Right. I didn't mention another way out of the withdrawing dilemma, but that would probably be very pertinent to the situation that you are describing, and I'm assuming that with time there will be more and more such treatments that will be, on the one hand, continuous, on the other hand, at some point, you have to stop it in some way because it won't make any more sense. The idea is that withholding treatment is okay not only at the beginning of the decision, which means that you make a decision that if this patient arrests, you won't put him on a ventilator. That's a classic withholding decision. Once he is on a ventilator, you can do two things. If you don't want it to continue, you can do two things. One is to pull the plug, which we said is forbidden. The other is to withhold further treatment on the ventilator. The fact that he is on the ventilator doesn't mean that he has to be treated with all the complications that come up just because he's on the ventilator. Even though he is on the ventilator, what you are not allowed is to hasten death. But you are still allowed to withhold treatment. Now, artificial hearts and similar technologies are very famous for the fact that they produce a lot of complications during the course. And if you will not run after every complication, the patient will die without you stopping the artificial heart. So therefore, you can give him the chance with artificial heart. You can put him on it, and you can treat it as long as you think it makes sense. Once you think it doesn't make any more sense, you're not allowed to withdraw it in order to kill the patient. but you are allowed to withhold treatment of further complications. And then obviously the patient will die. In fact, this is how we practice in the intensive care in Hadassah, Yerushalayim, where the head of the department there is a religious physician, an American, by the way, who made Aliyah. And I went with him to Rav Auerbach, who stipulated exactly how he should act in situations where a patient in the intensive care is on a respirator, we don't have yet a timer, still the patients don't live forever, even though you don't withdraw the treatment. And the reason they don't live forever is because they develop complications, and there are types of complications which you are not required to treat, and therefore the patients die. So they die by withholding treatment without withdrawing treatment, even though they are on a ventilator. And statistically, by the way, even if you withdraw a ventilator, some die instantaneously, and that's the major fear of doing such an action. But some still continue to live even after withdrawing the respirator. And I think the studies in Europe at least show that about 20 hours is the average of the patients who die after withdrawing. Now, if you withhold treatment on a ventilator, the statistics in Hadassah are 48 hours. So the difference on the average, statistically, is between 20 hours and 48 hours, whether you make a decision which is halachically wrong or you make a decision which is halachically correct. And I don't think that anyone can argue that it's worthwhile to save another 20 hours and do something which is absolutely wrong.
Okay. I'm sorry, I have to take a prerogative and cut it off. He'll be here all day and tonight, and you can ask questions, you know, privately and later on. Dr. Warren Gorstein wants to make a quick commercial announcement. We'll take a 5-minute break for coffee and cake, etc. And please, we'll start precisely 11:02 and 30 seconds.
Just please, one quick housekeeping note about the CME issues. There should be evaluation forms on every table. If you don't have them, you can...